Thank you so much, Mike, for your words. And now we're going to kick it off with our first session for the day, Supervision by Zila. And we also have Andrew, and they're both from our OTC Derivatives Compliance Department. Thank you.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Andrew Jones. I'm an associate director in NFA's OTC Derivatives Department.
Good morning. I'm Zila Bratman, and I'm a senior manager in the OTC Derivatives Department.
During this morning's session, Zila and I will be discussing swap dealer supervision of employee and training activities. The structure of today's panel will follow the pending supervision interpretive notice that many of you in the room will likely be familiar with. NFA worked diligently with the industry to make sure that the expectations outlined in the notice were clear, reasonable, and in line with existing CFTC and NFA regulations related to supervision. For many, the concepts and practices articulated today will very much align to your existing supervisory practices and should sound familiar as they very much adhere to the expectations that we discuss with you during NFA examinations of your firms. I'll start by discussing applicable NFA rules and CFTC regulations related to employee and trade supervision. Zila will discuss NFA's expectations around the creation and maintenance of a written supervisory program, the identification and designation of qualified personnel, and necessary steps to conduct in pre-hire due diligence. Zila will also touch on the capture, retention, and review of communication records. I'll close us out with a discussion on the review of trading activities and lastly provide some insights into training requirements. We do have a pretty full agenda. We want to make sure that we leave room for questions at the end, so let's jump right into it. Slide changed, great. So to start, NFA Compliance Rule 2-9D places a supervision obligation on all swap dealer members. Be certain there is no substituted compliance for NFA Compliance Rule 2-9. It applies to all swap dealers, irrespective of your country of domicile. The broad language of this rule provides the necessary flexibility for member swap dealers to craft supervisory programs tailored to your business models and risks associated with your model. Supervision is not a one-size-fits-all process. NFA's expectations under Compliance Rule 2-9 are sometimes clarified through interpretive notices when a topic requires such guidance. You may all be familiar with some of these interpretive notices, and in fact, there is a later session today where our colleagues will walk through a few more of them with you. As I previously mentioned, the pending supervision interpretive notice will also tie back to NFA Compliance Rule 2-9D. And again, interpretive notices, just as the rule themselves, are applicable to all members, irrespective of the location or availability of substituted compliance for certain CFTC regulations. That seems to be a good segue to our next topic, CFTC regulations. So CFTC Regulation 23602 places an obligation on registered swap dealers to diligently supervise all activities related to its business. The rule requires swap dealers to establish and maintain a system of supervision. Like the obligations of 2-9, the system of supervision created by the swap dealer should be reasonably designed around your business model with the objective of achieving compliance with the Commodity Exchange Act and CFTC regulations. A reasonably designed supervision program acknowledges that we are looking for a comprehensive set of processes and controls aimed at supervising your business. Elements such as the types of processes, the number of key processes, and the frequency at which these processes operate will necessarily depend on the nature of your model. And to repeat myself, and I'm sorry, I'm going to repeat myself a lot today. It's not because I have a bad memory, but it's because it's such an important concept. Supervision is not a one-size-fits-all concept. Joke didn't land. That's okay. 23602 also adds a specific requirement related to supervisory personnel. Specifically, the regulation establishes that each swap dealer must designate at least one person with the authority to carry out its supervisory responsibilities. Additionally, it requires that swap dealers' supervisory system take reasonable efforts to determine that all supervisors are qualified to carry out their functions. And in fact, Zila will touch on supervisory personnel a bit more shortly. 23602, unlike compliance rule 2-9, substituted compliance does mean that certain swap dealers are able to follow their non-U.S. prudential regulatory regime in achieving compliance with these requirements. It is still expected, however, that those firms that avail themselves of substituted compliance establish a system of supervision reasonably designed to achieve compliance with the Commodity Exchange Act and CFTC regulations. Additionally, not on the slide, but worth a mention, is 23402A, which requires swap dealers to have policies and procedures reasonably designed to comply with business conduct standards and prevent evasion of any provision of the Commodity Exchange Act or CFTC regulations. Furthermore, you all must implement and monitor compliance with such policies and procedures as a part of your supervision and risk management requirements. This expectation that swap dealers have reasonably designed policies and procedures is a perfect transition to our next topic, a written supervisory program, which Zila will walk us through.
Thank you, Andrew. Policies and procedures, a room full of compliance personnel, I know this is very near and dear to your hearts. So as you all know, well-documented policies and procedures help firms to adhere to regulations, reducing the risk of enforcement actions, fines, and reputational damage. And we find that firms with clear policies and procedures are better equipped to prevent violations and also to respond to regulatory inquiries. The first thing that needs to be considered when creating or updating policies and procedures is that they need to be tailored to your business. We recognize that although all of you here today are in the same swap dealer membership category, there are a lot of differences within our swap dealers. The first being U.S. versus non-U.S. This determines the scope of regulations applicable to your swap dealer, as well as the locations and languages that need to be considered. Next, the types of counterparties you transact with, as well as where they are located. This also determines the scope of regulations that are applicable. And in addition, markets and the products traded, as well as the volume of trading. This determines the amount of resources that would be needed to appropriately supervise activity, as well as the types of reviews that would be most meaningful. These are obviously just a few examples of some key differences, but I think it goes to show that a one-size-fits-all approach is not expected and not possible when creating policies and procedures for a swap dealer for supervisory functions. Firms have to determine the specific risks that they face and what diligent supervision looks like for their operations and their APs. Once this is determined, then the relevant policies and procedures can be developed and implemented. So let's talk about what good procedures look like. Good procedures need to outline how to identify, escalate, and resolve potential issues of noncompliance. And procedures need to include sufficient details on these three components. I'll now go over these details. So what is the frequency of the process? For example, if you're saying that it's a report that needs to be run to identify exceptions, the procedure needs to state how often this report needs to be run. Who are the individuals responsible for performing each function? So who is actually running this report? And if there are exceptions, who does it need to be escalated to? And lastly, how is all of this going to be documented? Because as we all know, if it's not documented and you can't produce it for a regulatory inquiry, we can't evidence that it ever happened. And one more thing to keep in mind here is the use of third-party service providers. If you're using a vendor to perform any relevant function for this area, that needs to be clearly described in the procedures, and the same level of detail needs to be included for the vendor perform functions. So thinking back to the frequency, documentation, etc. And with the use of third-party service providers, it's important to remember that ultimately your firm remains responsible for complying with the regulatory requirements. Okay, so now that we spoke about good procedures, and we all have procedures that include all of these components that I just went over, now we need to make sure that our procedures remain updated. So some things to consider here. New systems or changes to lines of business or activities. So this would obviously require a change or an adjustment to supervisory functions, either something would need to be added or updated. new offices or employees. So where are these new offices or employees located? Can an existing procedure be extended to cover them, or do you need to create a new procedure? Remote or hybrid operations. Can the procedure function the same way, whether employees working at a main office versus at home versus on vacation, or maybe you need a different procedure for remote operations? Something to consider. This all goes back to what I initially said about knowing what risks are applicable to your firm and developing supervisory functions to then address them. And before I move on from this slide, I'll end the section on policies and procedures by stressing that your written policies and procedures need to be reflective of what is truly happening at your firm. We very often see a set of great policies and procedures, and once we go into test, we quickly learn that the processes described in the procedures are very different than the processes that are actually being carried out daily. And vice versa, we might sometimes see poor or missing procedures, but still learn that the firm may have robust processes in place, but they just failed to adequately memorialize them in a procedure. So the takeaways from this slide are: develop a procedure that is tailored to your operations, provide details on the different supervisory functions, think back to identify, escalate, resolve, and make sure that your procedures remain up to date and are actually being implemented. So moving on from the written supervisory program, next I will talk about qualified supervisory personnel and pre-hiring due diligence. The proposed interpretive notice specifies that members must ensure that supervisory personnel are appropriately qualified to carry out their functions. So going back to the procedures I just spoke about, I mentioned that the procedures need to specify who is responsible for performing each supervisory function. So whether it's compliance, risk management, sales and trading, or some other business unit, whoever is carrying out a supervisory function needs to be identified and needs to be qualified in doing that function. Switching gears a little from the supervisory personnel, I'll talk a bit more about associated persons, or APs. Now, we all know that swap APs are not required to be registered with the CFTC or NFA, but swap dealers do have an obligation to identify individuals who act as swap APs, which, by definition, are persons who are involved in the solicitation or acceptance of swaps or the supervision of persons so engaged. If you're not keeping a comprehensive up-to-date list of swap APs, you will not be able to ensure that everyone is being properly supervised and trained. For instance, we've seen some firms fail to identify individuals carrying out swaps activity within the treasury function. Or in some other instances, we've seen relationship managers or private bankers involved in swaps activity. And in these cases, the firms considered this activity to be out of scope for the swap dealer business. However, once an entity is registered as a swap dealer, every swap executed out of that entity is considered to be in scope, unless there is a limited purpose designation in place. So the main point to take away here is make sure that your swap AP list is complete and accurate and doesn't potentially omit people who are engaging in swaps. Members must also conduct pre-hiring due diligence to ensure that prospective APs are qualified and eligible for their position. So essentially, there needs to be an adequate screening process when determining whether to hire a prospective AP. So what does an adequate screening process look like? I think the first and most obvious is conducting background checks. And along with that, confirming educational and employment history in accordance with your firm's hiring policy. Next, inquiring about any prior or pending disciplinary matters involving regulators, and if any are identified, the next step would be to conduct a review of these matters. Screening should also include ensuring that the individual is not statutorily disqualified. And lastly, confirming that a designated AP's representation that the NFA swaps proficiency requirements were completed at a prior employer. This piece is very important because the requirement is that they need to have completed this exam before the AP begins engaging in swaps. We do test for this pretty routinely as part of our exams. In addition to an adequate screening process, a member should also require its APs to notify the member of any new disciplinary, criminal, or other matter that may require disclosure. And the most common method that we see firms utilizing for this is the use of a periodic attestation. Okay. Next, I will be focusing on capturing, retaining, and reviewing required communications. NFA Compliance Rule 2-49, which incorporates CFTC Regulation 23202, imposes a requirement on swap dealer members to maintain records of all oral and written pre-trade communications, including internal communications that lead to the execution of a transaction. In order to comply with this, swap dealer members must have appropriate written policies and procedures in place to ensure that they are able to properly capture and maintain such records. The first step is making sure that APs are communicating on devices and on channels that will allow the firm to capture and retain the communication. So what is the scope of applications or devices that need to be captured and retained? Well, that's where all of you here come in. You have to determine what is allowable for your firm. Your policies and procedures should specify what types of applications or devices are approved for use, and presumably any other channel that's not identified as approved for use should be considered unapproved or unallowable. Your policies also need to be clear on the use of cell phones. Some firms prefer to prohibit personal cell phones and only allow firm-issued devices, while other firms may allow personal devices as long as the proper applications are used. Either of these methods are fine, as long as the devices are set up to capture and retain communications, and as long as it's being done in accordance with your policies. Along with having a clearly defined approved devices and channels list, APs should also be prohibited from using unapproved methods of communication. Once again, a very common method that we see nowadays to enforce this prohibition is requiring APs to test periodically that they have acted in compliance with the firm's policies on the use of off-channel communications. So once you have determined your population of approved communication methods, next you have to ensure that all of these devices and channels are set up to be captured and retained by the firm. So this shouldn't be some one-time set-it-and-forget-it exercise. You need to have processes in place to ensure that systems are functioning properly and can identify potential outages or loss of communications. So I spoke about capturing and retaining communications. The next order of business is the review of these communications. Communications review is a crucial part of supervisory oversight of APs. And this review needs to be reasonably designed to identify potential violations of various regulatory requirements. Back to my discussion on procedures. What should good procedures for this area look like? So first, it should include the methodology of these reviews. So what is the frequency and the scope? When determining the methodology, once again, we know this is very much not one size fits all. There are several factors to consider. The overall volume of trading activity, the communication methods that are used by the traders, so are they using telephone, email, messaging applications, and any risks that may be applicable to a particular trading desk or AP. So I'm thinking, have there been any prior counterparty complaints? Are there any new product types that have been approved? Have there been previous violations of internal policies? And last but not least, what are the languages that are being spoken? If APs are conducting business in other languages, the firm needs to know what languages are being used and come up with a reasonable risk-based methodology for conducting surveillance in those languages. We very often get asked about this. Common example, hey, we identified this language as being spoken by a handful of APs with a handful of clients. Do we really need to build automated surveillance around this? No. We are not saying you need to build automated surveillance, but you also can't say that you will ignore it completely. Do a sample, a periodic review of an AP, show us that something is being done. In addition to methodology, the procedure needs to include who is conducting the review and what do they need to document as part of their review. And in a similar vein, who needs to be included on escalations and what type of documentation needs to be included. Now I'll go over the key things that communication reviews should be focusing on. Your review should be looking for communications that may imply fraud or deceit, are not fair or balanced, indicate potential manipulative behavior or market abuse, disclose a counterparty's identity or information without their consent, display instances of noncompliance with applicable disclosure requirements, discuss unreported counterparty complaints, and last but not least, display that something might be missing from the captured communications, meaning you don't have the full picture and potentially off-channel communication methods may have been used. Now, depending on what type of surveillance you're doing, it could be very hard to find off-channel communications. How do you search for something that isn't there, right? So this is where trade reconstruction comes in. Trade reconstruction in itself is not a regulatory requirement. However, it does prove to be a very beneficial exercise to do, particularly for the purpose of identifying missing communications. So once your surveillance is set up and you have a well-documented procedure that outlines the review process and escalation process, in practice, you will be identifying potentially problematic communications. So once this happens and you begin your review or investigation in accordance with your procedures, it's important to remember that communications are just one piece of the puzzle, and looking at the communications alone is not enough to reach a conclusion. This is where you'd need to also incorporate the review of trading activity associated with the flagged communications and consider reconstructing the trading activity. For these escalated items that go through investigation, it's also very important to have good documentation around this. As you all know, routinely as part of our examinations, we always request trader incidents that have occurred since the last exam. And this process goes a lot more smoothly when we're able to get this information with sufficient level of detail that allows us to determine which do we want to further explore, if any. For the items that we do choose to explore, a firm must be able to provide us with all of the corresponding communications and must be able to do so promptly. As for the scope of trader incidents that we're looking for, the scope of the incidents that you must disclose is essentially all of them. We're looking for incidents that were investigated and concluded no findings, incidents that were investigated and concluded some sort of wrongdoing, as well as incidents that are still pending investigation. To close out our last bullet here, ongoing checks. This refers to ensuring that your review of communications is effective. So a couple of examples. If you're using automated surveillance, looking to reduce the number of false positives. If you're using lexicons, making sure that your keywords are up to date. If you're using AI and machine learning, making sure that models are being tested and are operating as intended. So we don't dictate how you measure the effectiveness of your surveillance, but however you do it, it needs to be documented because this is something that we do obtain and assess as part of our examinations when we examine your surveillance program. So with that, I'll hand it back over to Andrew to continue the discussion on trade surveillance.
Thanks, Zila. Excuse me. Next, we'll discuss the review of trading activities. CFTC regulations and NFA rules require swap dealers to adequately supervise your trading activities. The supervision of these trading activities must be appropriately tailored to your operations to address the risks, the unique risks of your business, including but not limited to factors such as your size, overall complexity, your products traded, and prior issues identified. Every product comes with its own unique risk profile, so assessment of the types of market abuse scenarios used in conjunction with each traded product is necessary to design an adequate program. Ultimately, the swap dealer must ensure that adequate coverage is in place for all in-scope products. Approaches to supervising trading activities include, but are not limited to, that's an important caveat, reviewing trade data for behaviors such as wash trading, front running, spoofing, off-market pricing, the review of daily profits and losses, as well as the mark-to-market of positions to identify potential fraudulent activities, monitoring post-trade activities, reviewing excessive markups and excessive markdowns, and monitoring of firm and trading desk limits. Again, this is more of an illustrative list of the types of approaches firms may use and should not be read as an exhaustive list of the required trading surveillance activities that we expect from you. It remains critical that you craft a supervisory and surveillance program that fits your business model. As you set out to design your supervision or surveillance program, you may find that some processes are better served by running in an automated fashion, while others can be carried out manually. Swap dealer must decide when a manual review process is inappropriate given the nature of the product traded, the volume of the trading activity, and other factors that may not lend themselves to manual supervision. No matter the path a swap dealer takes, its trading activity supervision methodology must be documented and fit for purpose. Your methodology spells out how you approach trading supervision both in the technical sense, meaning automated versus manual, but also in the scope, frequency, and depth of coverage. Methodology is not a one-size-fits-all exercise. Different approaches for different products, different trading desks, different regions, different execution methods are all factors that may be considered. Your methodology should also discuss the setting and adjustments of parameters that impact the sensitivity of your surveillance processes. These surveillance activities may be achieved using a vended product, an in-house build, or a combination of the two. As Zila mentioned, the swap dealer remains responsible for complying with CFTC regulations and NFA rules, even if a third-party service provider is used. It's recommended that if a swap dealer's trade surveillance process identifies potential or actual fraudulent or abusive activities, the program requires the review of associated communications related to that activity and consider expanding the review to other activities of that employee or similarly situated individuals. What this means is that looking at the single offending trade alone may not always be sufficient. You may need to build a more fulsome picture of the activity, a broader picture of that AP, of that product, or even the entire desk. The program should also include processes for issues and concerns to be escalated to compliance or other appropriate supervisory personnel. This escalation process should be documented, and any actual escalations should be adequately documented from the point of identification through the closure of the matter. The swap dealer should also perform periodic assessments of the effectiveness of its supervisory or surveillance program. This assessment should be aimed at ensuring that the measures that you've put in place and the parameters used to calibrate the sensitivity of these processes remain appropriate for the many factors that influenced its design. These factors include the business model, your products traded, and the order handling systems used. Beyond this periodic assessment of the effectiveness of the program, swap dealers should also have processes in place to perform checks that the systems are actually operating as intended. These processes should allow you to detect outages or disruptions in a timely manner and correct those issues promptly. We'll wrap it up with training. With all the components of an adequate supervisory system in place, there's still a need to ensure that personnel are always aware of their obligations under NFA and CFTC requirements, as well as your own firm policies. Member firms are expected to provide training to APs before they begin interacting with customers or counterparties and on an ongoing basis. This training should be geared at ensuring that employees understand your regulatory obligations and the firm's policies. These trainings should be given at regular intervals, and we see many of our swap dealers providing such trainings on an annual basis. If you become aware of material changes to pertinent rules or regulations or changes to your firm's business model, you should make every effort to provide training on these changes and their impact to the swap dealer as soon as practicable. Certainly, there is flexibility in how the training is delivered. We see and expect to continue to see swap dealers use a variety of forms to deliver training, including in-person sessions, virtual sessions, bulletins, or a combination of those methods. Regardless of the methods that you choose, we expect that you maintain a record of who attended the training, what they were trained on, when it was delivered, when it comes to evidencing the completion of training. Beyond training, we also see as a best practice, firms require employees to acknowledge their receipt and review of firm policies and procedures. Okay, we've made it to the end. Not so bad, right? Zila and I are happy to take any questions that you all have about supervision.
Thank you, Andrew, Zila. Thank you, guys. It's very useful. You started off by talking about how understanding the risks of the business is important to tailoring the supervision program to the individual registrant. Curious what better practices you've seen firms employ to understand those risks.
Yeah, sure. So I've seen firms deploy and provide to us a matrix of the products traded, and this is on the traded product side, so on the trading supervision side, a matrix of the traded products and the inherent risk of manipulation associated with those products, and and the associated surveillance mechanism that they have in place. It was a really detailed matrix that helped evidence to us that they've thought about each product, the risk associated with that product, and how they were aiming to get their arms around it. Certainly, that much granularity was appreciated. But I think the takeaway there was that having a clear and articulable sense of your products and how you intend and what you recognize as the risk of that product to be in designing your program was considered. Other practices, Zila, that you see?
Yeah, I would say, you know, for communications, definitely the analysis of what languages are being used, and also to add for trade surveillance, like how is a particular product being executed? Are your traders going out and, you know, looking in the market, or is the person coming to them? Is the client coming straight to them? That makes a difference as well, in terms of determining what risks might arise there.
Hi. I guess similar to that question, where do you see the most issues through examination, like the biggest risk and something that firms aren't managing or could be managing better?
We will have a common exam finding session. I don't want to take all of their thunder, but I will speak to it a little bit. An area that I see of significant risk, I think I'll let you talk about foreign language probably, but product coverage. Many of you all here are registered in multiple capacities. You trade across many, many markets. You know, the spot market, the equities markets, the futures market, and swap products. And what we've seen is an incomplete coverage model, whereby you are not covering all of your swap products in a complete fashion, and in some cases not at all, relying instead on, say, coverage of a related futures market. That seems to be an area where we're seeing some gaps, as well as an inability, or not even an inability to evidence, but no checks of the robustness of the system. So during my session, I spoke a bit on having processes in place to detect outages or disruptions in a timely manner and correct those issues promptly. During examinations through requests, sometimes firms themselves become aware of an outage that must have occurred because the requested records were not available. So having a process in place where you are proactively assessing the system's health to ensure that it is performing as designed is another area that we've seen some issues in.
Yeah, Andrew mentioned the foreign languages, right? So one issue would be not being aware of what languages are being spoken, so not doing an adequate analysis to identify that. And then another scenario would be being aware but still not implementing something to cover some of the less spoken languages, which, like I said, it's not an adequate response, really. Something needs to be done.
Hey, Andrew Zila, thank you. Could you talk about how what types of supervisory failures may be recommended for enforcement, particularly with the CFTC's shift in their enforcement focus? Thank you.
I would say, you know, the failure to identify manipulation and abuse, right? I think that will be the primary focus for the CFTC. At NFA, I think, you know, we will continue to look at all aspects of the supervisory functions. You know, we don't have any changes in that regard. So I think we'll still be assessing the full suite as we always have been.
Yeah, I think Zila hit it right. It's instances of actual manipulation or fraud occurring within your swap dealer, and your systems being inadequately designed to identify this these instances or in some cases prevent them through robust limits and such. Those are the types of failures that that. I think the Commissioner Pham has talked about. To Zila's point, we will continue to assess the adequacy of the system as a whole, not just in whether or not a failure occurred, but also we'll assess whether or not you have a reasonably designed process fit to your business model in place.
For the rules associated with unauthorized communications, we've seen a couple ambiguities come up in industry groups and different questions over the years since these enforcement actions became such a hot topic. Where do you draw the line where an associated person might be attending industry conferences and have general views of the market, and they might be discussing those things generally in a personal capacity, but then they're not really getting into indicative pricing or actual discussions about business? Where, in your view, is a safe place to draw that line? Where things would need to be recorded? Because if I have a general view of a semiconductor market, for instance, and maybe a client might be interested in hedging equities in that space, where do you draw the line from, this is my general view of this market, and this is what I'm discussing at an industry event, and what needs to be recorded eventually in an authorized communication?
Right. So I think, Zila, you touched on it a little bit, but
you can touch on it, yeah.
Oh yeah, no, I absolutely will. I just want to make sure I was remembering it correctly. The expectation is certainly that you are capturing all communication that lead up to the execution of a swap. So I mean, in your hypothetical conversation at an industry conference, I don't think would likely lead it to the execution of a swap. I think the line does get challenging for some firms that try to parse out where that is occurring. That is certainly a challenging thing to know. So that's I have not seen many firms be able to say, well, I'm going to have this AP start recording at this moment, because this is where the conversation shifts to the execution of the swap. But those are the conversations that need to be recorded. So.
Yeah, I think a good way to think about it is the trade reconstruction, right? Like, if you're able to get the full picture by reconstructing the trade, then you know that you captured everything, right? But if you can't, then that means that maybe there was a component that should have been recorded. So that's, I think, the best way I could answer the question, given the hypothetical, right? Not knowing exactly what was said at that conference.
Thank you.
These are all great questions, by the way. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. Zila and I will be hanging around. If anyone has any additional questions for us, happy to take those. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.